Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent.
David is co-hosting today with David Stearns, president of Dale Carnegie, Maine.
And you're listening to the HR Power Hour, presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. And today we are going to do part two of our series talking about employment immigration. And basically today we're going to be talking with our good friend Nathan Warwicki. He is with the law firm of Sheehan Finney. And he is going to be on the line as he is, or was, I should say, last week. He's come back from more abuse. That's right. More abuse, Nathan. How are you?
Very good. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Great to have you back. And today, of course, I, David Chulo, will be your host. And we have a co-host again today, David Stearns. David, welcome.
Oh, thank you.
Good to see you.
Good to see you. Good to see you, Nathan.
Good to hear you.
Yeah. It's all good. That's right. It's here. We're on the radio, Dave. It's all good.
I wonder if he'd catch that.
We like it. Yeah. All right. So, you know, last week, Nathan, we were talking about employment immigration. And the reason that we ended up with a part two is because, as simple as it sounded, you know, you just go to the fence and the border and you hop over and you come in and you work. It's not that simple, is it?
That's right, Dave. It's a whole hodgepodge of rules and regulations, and it can create quite the challenge for the business owner here in the United States.
Yeah, there's no question that as we looked at last week, we talked about things like a quota system, and there are some quota systems for certain countries. We talked about areas where they have to really go through a whole bunch of processes and certifications to get in. They have to be able to have passed certain tests. They have to be educated in a certain way. We talked about a lot of this last week. Could you kind of give like an overview, if you would, of the current state of the law once again to get everybody kind of up to speed as to, you know, employment immigration?
Sure. You know, we talked about the two main ways in which foreign workers come to the United States, and one is through an immigrant visa, which is at least permanent residence, and we talked about non-immigrant visa classifications, which is that alphabet soup of visa types. And so really, when you're talking about having someone come to the United States, you're probably first talking about how to get them here as quickly as possible, because there's probably a business need that's been identified. And so then you get into those non-immigrant visa classifications and which is the most appropriate for whatever activities the employee or the proposed employee or the transferee is going to be performing in the United States.
We also then talked about temporary versus permanent immigration. How about a quick recap on that?
Sure. So the immigrant visa classifications, the permanent immigrations, divide into five preference categories, and those are prioritized based on skills and education. For most immigrants to the United States, the path ultimately concludes with that process where the employer has to obtain a labor market test certification saying that there are no U.S. workers who can fill the position. The qualifications of the foreign worker are vetted through the immigration process, and ultimately the alien's awarded a green card and then can fulfill whatever duties they're meant to here in the United States. It's a multi-year process in many situations. So when you're looking to get that person to the United States as quickly as possible, you go to those letters. Last time we talked about a few different non-immigrant visa classifications that included the B, which is for temporary business activities, not employment, but business activities here in the United States. F visas for students who ultimately will have some practical training opportunities, so opportunities to work in the United States. Exchange visitors, J. H, temporary workers, who many of your listeners are probably the most familiar with that particular classification. That includes H-1Bs, which are your high-tech workers, H-2As and H-2Bs, which are your temporary workers in agricultural and non-agricultural settings. L visas for transferees between U.S. companies and their foreign affiliates. And I think we concluded with e-visas, which are visas based on trade agreements, investment treaties between the United States and a number of other countries across the world.
Yes, we went through a lot of this, and obviously anybody can go to hrpowerhour.com and listen to last week's show. It's all there ready to be listened to. But, you know, one of the things we didn't talk a little bit about was the treaty non-immigrant status. And can you talk a little bit about that, and as we finish the alphabet soup, before we get into what I think will be really interesting is common employment-based immigration scenarios, which is where we're going to go after this.
Yes, the e-visa, that's based on investment treaties that go back to the early 19th century between the United States and countries like France and the UK and all sorts of other countries. And we talked a little bit about those visas last episode. But probably the one that many of listeners might be familiar with for the treaty is NAFTA and its provision for TN professionals.
What is a TN?
So a TN is the... is the classification that was negotiated between the United States, Canada, Mexico, pursuant to the NAFTA Treaty in 1994, I believe it was, that prescribes a list of about 20 professions where the visa requirements are much reduced to facilitate the flow of goods and people between the treaty countries. And so, especially in the border regions and in this part of the country, there's a lot of incoming TN professionals who work in a variety of different settings. So that includes your engineers. By the way, these are all listed directly in the NAFTA treaty, the types of jobs and also the qualifications required. So you have your scientists, your engineers. You have a number of professions that would not qualify for H-1B status, which would qualify for TN. So there's some peculiarities there. You have some issues with making sure that licenses are in place. So part of NAFTA is not only providing for the movement of people, but also labor protections for the workers in the host country. So, for instance, in the United States, you have to, if you're going to have someone come be an engineer, they may qualify for licensure, so you need to make sure that's all in place. And also, if there's a strike for the U.S. employer, then there's no TN available. So that's kind of an interesting intersection between immigration and international commercial law there. The other two that are of note are two visa classifications that are based upon treaties between the United States and three other countries, and this is Chile, Singapore, and Australia. Those are the H-1B1 and E-3 classifications, and those have an interesting history because they were negotiated pursuant to free trade agreements before Congress decided it was no longer going to do that. So many people have probably heard about the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Yes.
And people might be surprised to know that while other party countries to that treaty have negotiated special visa statuses for their nationals, the United States has not negotiated any sort of preferential visa treatment for people coming into the United States. Whereas For instance, in the U.S.-Chilean Free Trade Agreement, that was negotiated, same thing with Singapore. And then for Australia, that particular visa classification, the E-3, was negotiated as part of a free trade agreement between the U.S. and Australia, which coincided with the Iraqi war. And many people think that that was part of the negotiations. Australia would commit treasure and troops to the effort, but they extracted some preferential visa treatment for their nationals. So that's kind of interesting.
Interesting, sure.
Political thing, too.
Well, it's all politics, isn't it? It is all politics. Hey, you know, the last alphabet soup, if you want to say, the last one is the O classification. What does that really apply to?
O is for folks who have extraordinary abilities in different fields, in the arts, science, education, business and athletics. So an O is for your Oppenheimer or Albert Einstein type person, but also for folks who haven't received quite that level of renown or recognition, but do have stature in their field. So when you're trying to figure out if someone qualifies for O, either they have to have a Nobel Prize or a similar type of international recognition, or there's a list of criteria in the statutes and regulations where if you satisfy at least three, you can achieve the O recognition.
Considering this year was the Olympics, is that the type of, you know, classification that's used to bring the Olympic athletes in?
Probably not for an event like the Olympics. So, for instance, if the U.S. was awarded the Olympics in some future year here, athletes from other countries would probably not use an O because it does require an employment relationship with the U.S. entity.
Gotcha, okay. Yep.
They would probably use a business visitor or a probably B visa for that type of entry. But an O would be used for someone like, let's say, David Ortiz, who came into the United States and did not have any sort of status, but he needed some sort of status to play ball for the Red Sox or for the Twins before that. So I think in his case, he started with a P visa, which we're not talking about here, but that's for athletes. But ultimately, he probably could have achieved an O because of the World Series wins and his recognitions with baseball. So that's kind of a case-by-case basis, and the type of evidence that's required for that really depends on how you define the field. And there's some interesting cases on that. For instance, there's a recent unpublished decision from the Immigration Service concerning a world-class rower and their coach and kind of the criteria that applied to them. We've used that classification for folks who have achieved recognition in their business field, and that's available. It's a high threshold, and it probably is not your first option for many different employees, but it does do the job where there's the evidence, and it's a fun case to do, at least from my end, because you really get into the details and kind of the politics of whatever the field is that they're going into.
Sure.
It's also available and used heavily in Hollywood for actors who are coming to the United States to work on productions. So, you know, we don't get a lot of that here in New Hampshire or Maine, but if you're in Southern California, New York, you probably would get a lot more of those.
Sure, of course. Well, we're talking with David Warwicki. He is an employment attorney with Sheehan Finney. And we and you, Debbie, and you are listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM. And we will be right back. If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
Like the taste of fresh apples? Looking for something a little different? Try an Angry Orchard hard cider. We use traditional cider apples from a 100-year-old orchard. It takes two apples to make each bottle of Angry Orchard. So at the end of the day, relax and raise a glass to something a little unexpected. Angry Orchard. Crisp, refreshing, and not too sweet. And now, in cans. Angry Orchard Hot Cider. Branch out.
Angry Orchard Cider Company. Walden, New York. Drink responsibly.
At 154 years old, Veryl Dana has an illustrious history and more than seven generations of legal expertise. With more than 130 attorneys across seven offices from Maine to Washington, D.C., Veryl Dana serves clients across the country and around the world. HR professionals, business leaders, and in-house counsel count on Veryl Dana, one of the premier labor and employment law practices in the Northeast. Contact them today at veryldana.com.
Join the Northeast Human Resource Association at their annual conference from September 28th through 30th in Falmouth, Massachusetts. See why the NERA conference is sure to be 2.5 days of HR education you won't want to miss. With awesome keynotes, you'll be sure to leave Falmouth with new resources and key knowledge to support you in your career and earn up to 15.5 SHRM and HRCI credits. Register now at nehra.com or by calling 781-235-2900.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at JacksonLewis.com. That's JacksonLewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour, presented by CMAKorea.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. And I'm your host, David Chulo, today here with co-host David Stearns, and we're talking to Nathan Waricki. He is the employment attorney at Sheehan Finney. And we're talking about employment immigration. And this is our second show on this topic because there is so much, Nathan. Oh, my gosh, there is so much information on this. What I'd like to do is David Stearns is going to kind of take you through some of these scenarios. We're going to kind of talk about the scenario and have you kind of talk about how it works, if you could, in terms of the question. Does that work for you?
Absolutely.
Okay. So I'm going to have Dave take me through the first scenario we're coming up with here.
All right. I've got one here on, it's a foreign affiliate one, and it's the scene is a company has recently opened, for instance, a new sales office in Italy. And they've hired a sales manager who is Italian, and he's going to be in charge of sales and marketing for all of Europe. He's going to have a small staff there, but also authority over personnel in the United States as part of his responsibilities. So the management of the company, as part of the training, wants him to be able to travel to and from the United States without restriction. I'm just wondering what you would recommend. Where does somebody like that start, or a company like that start?
Sure. Well, you know, that happens a lot in the United States, and with the globalization, there's a lot of cross-border business organizations, and so this is a pretty common scenario, either going the way you just described, or there's a parent in another country and they have a U.S. sales office. Whenever you have that situation, the first place you always turn to is an L visa, and the reason is because that's the purpose of the visa. It's to facilitate the movement of people between related companies here in the U.S. and abroad. So in that particular situation, it sounds like the person would qualify for the L1A visa. Mm-hmm. That's for managers and executives. The good thing about an L visa is there's not a lot of oversight during the stay. So once the person has their visa, assuming they have met the criteria for having a managerial type position and will be actually in charge of either people or a function of the company, assuming you meet those hurdles, then you can go ahead and get that visa and the person can come and go pretty much as they please, so long as that employment relationship or that relationship between the related companies continues.
So I'm just curious, how is that managed? How is that, I hate to use the word policed, but how does our government know that is in fact what's happening? Are there reporting requirements and things like that?
Well, the L1A is good for a three-year period. So when you initially start that process, you file a petition with the Immigration Service here in the United States. That petition contains all the evidence that's required to show that there's a qualifying relationship between the entities and that the person is going to be performing their managerial or executive function here in the U.S. Once that petition is approved, then the person actually has to get a visa in their passport to facilitate travel. And when they do that, they submit to biometric collection, so fingerprints and copies of signatures and so on and so forth. Those are all electronically collected at the consulate. Well, most countries in the world have e-passports now, so all the data concerning trips to and fro the United States is aggregated in some databases. You can actually do a Freedom of Information Act request on yourself with the Customs and Border Patrol if anyone's ever interested in doing that. You can see what kind of data the U.S. government's keeping on everybody.
Whoa.
the other part of that
I don't want to know what they know about me. How's that?
Best left unsaid.
So the so that's how it's policed. It's, there's not a lot of policing during the three-year period. There's data collection. But after those 3 years have gone by, then you have to file a new petition where you have to provide updated information concerning the employment and the continued relationship between the companies and the evidence that the companies are still doing business, both in the U.S. and, in this case, in Italy, through the sales. So, you know, financial documents and corporate documents and maybe some copies of contracts and that sort of thing. That's how you show it.
Okay.
There's actually also a lot of scrutiny on the L visa program, although not necessarily for managers, but for workers with specialized knowledge in Congress. There's kind of a perennial push to have more regulation on the L and the H classifications from the Senate subcommittee on this. And so that's always kind of a ping pong ball between politicians and perhaps people who are actually running these programs, between we want to facilitate the movement of people because it's good for the U.S. economy to have investment and cross-border ease of travel, but we also want to make sure that people aren't defrauding the government. So that happens a lot, that discussion.
That makes sense. Hey, we're talking with Nathan Waricki. He is an employment attorney at Sheehan Finney. Dave, I know you had a second scenario, so why don't you go ahead and give him that one?
Sure. This one's a little closer to home, maybe. I'm an HR director for a four-season resort, and let's say it's in Maine or the White Mountains of New Hampshire. I'm just wondering if there's any difference there. But the high seasonal demands go beyond what the rural population can support. So what's somebody to do to get some housekeeping and some groomers and things like that in for the ski season?
This is a common scenario for industries like you just mentioned, and many, you know, your listeners may go to a ski slope and see a bunch of people who don't look like they're from the area, and that might be the case. The hospitality industry uses temporary visas and exchange visitors visas to augment their workforces. So typically that process starts many months before the season actually begins. And the process is for the HR director to identify what their projected shortfall is going to be, so try to figure out how many workers they're going to need to facilitate the operations. They're going to have to identify the length of that need, and that's probably easy for a ski area where it depends on the weather. maybe not so easy if you're talking about a seaside resort in Maine where, of course, the weather can turn on a dime. So once you've identified your shortfall and the length of your need, many employers employ or contract with foreign recruiters or local recruiters who have foreign contacts to get identify people who might be able to come in. And that's if you're going to use the H-2B program. There's also the opportunity to try and augment the workforce through exchange programs. And for winter ski areas, many of the people who come to work on exchange programs are using the summer work travel classification, J classification. Mm-hmm. Those visas are available to folks who are attending university in their home country, but then they have a summer break and they can come to the United States for a few months and work. And so it doesn't really have an educational component, just to work during the break. And in the winter, of course, summer is in the southern hemisphere, so you might find a lot of South American, Chilean, Argentine folks who are here in the winter here working on ski slopes to try to augment. So the HR director's task is really to make sure that agreements with recruiting partners and the maybe existing exchange programs is in place, because those agreements do cover a number of different topics, including the types of information that must be disclosed to the workers, the pay rate that must be used for those workers, the deductions that are authorized from their paychecks for things like housing and transportation, and also some lawyer talk here, but allocation of risk between all the parties.
What about? Is there a time limit on this? Is it open ended, or is it seasonal? When it says seasonal, is there any flexibility there?
Yeah, if you're using a J exchange program, then your season is really limited by the length of the worker's break, so it probably is only a few months. If you're using the H-2B program, the need is based on the employer's needs. So you have to have a kind of a documented. So you wouldn't use this if you're a startup ski area, which there aren't many, but if you were, you probably wouldn't be able to use this program because you have to have a documented need, either shown through a spike in revenue or a spike in, you know, riders ski area through a certain number of months, or a dip in employment numbers during those times to show that there's a need for more folks, or you can't find enough workers in the area during certain months.
So Nathan, one of the questions, this is David Chulo again, a question is, can somebody come in on one visa, suddenly find another job and switch visas? Is there a way to go from one to the other? Let's say that, they come over, they're working for this hospitality group, and 3 months in, someone contacts them and says, hey, you're really a good worker, and I want you to go work at XYZ company for me, and it's, of course, nothing hospitality, but they're willing to pay more. How does that work of this scenario if somebody comes in, but they get taken to another spot? Mm-hmm. Can they do that, number one, and how do they go through that process if that's the case?
So it depends mostly on what visa classification they're using. But if we're going to use the H-2B example, people do end up staying in the United States year-round, even though that visa is only meant for a few months per employer. So a worker may spend the winter months up north working in hospitality or ski or other sort of winter sports employers, but then they may transition to something like landscaping or concrete pouring or something during the winter, during the construction season or the summer seasons. Each of those employment relationships requires a different petition. In the H-2B context, it requires a separate labor market test from each employer and a separate visa, frankly, for each engagement. So it's certainly doable and people do that, but it is a lot of expense to the employer, and that may make it prohibitive, of course, because then the costs of employing someone go up. And also, there's the numerical cap on H-2B visas that we talked about last week. And so in some cases, it may be that you can get an H-1B for one season, but the visas are all used up for the second season. Then you're kind of stuck up the creek without a paddle, so to speak.
Sure. So we have another scenario that David's going to take you through. And this really talks about kind of an entry-level worker.
Right. This scenario has to do with an impressive young woman that has some IT background and experience and knowledge that's very impressive to a company. But during the interview, she states that she's applied for OPT. So what's the implication of that?
Yeah, OPT is very commonly associated with foreign students. And so that should give you, as the employer, a indication this person is going to need some extra attention to make that employment relationship work.
Oh.
OPT stands for Optional Practical Training. Whenever a foreign student comes to the United States, they get at least a year of OPT following the completion of their studies.
Okay.
So OPT is based upon the student's relationship with their university. So actually, the employer doesn't need to do much of anything for that initial year. But that would prompt the employer to start discussing with the employee their longer-term desires and also the employer's need after that first year, because the H-1B category is probably what that person would transition to if they're working in a high-tech field. But for the reasons we discussed last week, that particular visa category is capped numerically as well and oversubscribed almost every year since its inception in 1991. And so it does require a lot of lead-up time and a lot of preparation to make sure that the employer is not missing out on the visa lottery, and also to make sure that the employee can maintain their status while they're starting out in their career with your employer.
When we're talking about employees that come in this category, does it matter what country they come in from? For example, it might be India, or what if they're coming out of Russia, or they're coming out of a country that may not have as favorable employment relations or even as favorable relations with the U.S. How does that work?
Well, there are a few countries where there are straight-up embargoes, and that can create some issues in these types of categories. And those are countries like North Korea and Syria, and also, although to a lesser extent, Iran, because some of those sanctions were recently lifted. But countries like Russia and every other country in the world, if the person is dealing, if the person will be working in an area where there is sensitive technologies or military applications of the products that the person is working on, that can lead to analysis under the export rules of the United States. And that's kind of a very intricate and fact-specific analysis, but it should, your listeners should be aware that that can come up, and there is a requirement for at least the H-1B and the O categories to vet that out to make sure that if the person is going to be exposed to sensitive technologies, either they can do so, or if there's any source of control over it, the employer may need to get a license from the Department of Commerce before that employment relationship commences. So that's kind of a probably unknown.
Sure, a little bit of a
note.
We're talking with Nathan Warwicki. He is an employment attorney with Sheehan Finney. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM, and we will be right back. Running a company can feel like you're surrounded. A key person quits. A big project presents itself. You need good people fast. Hello. I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Our contract staffing service will fill a position or find the right talent for a short-term project. Hundreds of companies choose us because we deliver people that fit. Career Management Associates, your contract staffing solution. Go to cmacareer.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
Join the Northeast Human Resource Association at their annual conference from September 28th through 30th in Falmouth, Massachusetts. See why the NERA conference is sure to be 2.5 days of HR education you won't want to miss. With awesome keynotes, you'll be sure to leave Falmouth with new resources and key knowledge to support you in your career and earn up to 15.5 SHRM and HRCI credits. Register now at nehra.com or by calling 781-235-2900. And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLLB, presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. And today we're talking with Nathan Warwicki. He's an employment attorney with Sheehan Finney. We're talking about employment immigration. I'm your host, David Chulo, and our co-host, David Stearns. And we're having some great discussions on some actual real-life immigration scenarios that happen each and every day. So, Nathan, this is your opportunity to shine a little bit here, okay? I'm going to give you the floor. Tell me why an employer should take the time to really have to do this with counsel versus spending the time to just go online and do it online. What are the risks asserted to this, and what are the things that really are important to think about legal counsel for these type of events?
Well, you know, when I go over all those classifications and I talk about them on a very generalized basis, it doesn't sound very difficult. It might sound kind of confusing, but, you know, that's what Google's for, right?
so true.
But when you get into the weeds and when you talk about what people can actually do in their different visa classifications, and when you consider that most of these employment relationships and most of these immigration processes last for many years, then you can start to think about what the consequence of a small mistake can be. There are any number of cases from the Immigration Service, the immigration courts in the United States, that should be a caution to employers, because when things go bad, it doesn't only affect the employer in terms of losing the employee that they've probably invested some time and energy into, but it also has very real consequences for the employee and their ability to stay in the United States, or in some cases, their ability to return to the United States, and that can impact both them and their families, of course, as well. So there's a risk of loss of the resources of the employee to the employer. There's an opportunity cost associated with mistakes, and there's also the personal consequences for the employee. And I would also note that many of the immigration processes that are out there are based upon business practices that existed in the early 2000s. And at that time, you know, there were no iPhones, there was no mobile internet, and so many of the processes are kind of grounded in that that time period and what was a business practice then. And it also means that the technology that underlines some of these processes is antiquated and cannot be corrected if there are small mistakes once the submission has been made. And so in the labor certification context, for instance, if you have just a small mistake, a Scrivener's error, they call it, in a petition. So let's say that you file an application and you say your employee needs to have 3 years of experience in a position to qualify, but in actuality, it's only two, so just a mistake, but two and substituting for a three. Well, that can mean that your employee is no longer qualified for that position, and that mistake may not be detected until that labor certification is approved, and that's probably not going to happen for a year. And so then you've just wasted a year of your employee's time and yours, and it's not a mistake that can be corrected. It has to kind of start all over again.
Oh, my God.
So well, that's amazing that they, you know, there isn't a, a route to fix that. And of course, I'm not terribly surprised, but it is interesting that the process is so strict, which I gather is probably a good thing, but it is.
I will tell you, there was a case that came out yesterday from the Board of Immigration, Alien Labor Certification Appeals, and in that case, the employer's permanent resident sponsorship was kind of nixed because they had indicated that they received 62 applications from U.S. workers for the position that they wanted to have the foreign worker fill. But in actuality, there were only 61 applicants. So their report said there were 62. There's actually only 61, and the board said that was a error that merited denial.
Oh, my gosh.
Wow.
That was a case that from start to finish, probably took about 2.5 years. And so then you're left without anything at that point. So that's the reason for why having an immigration counsel is a good idea, having second pair of eyes and everything, and certainly having someone to guide the employer through the requirements, which are very strict and strictly enforced as well.
No, I mean, I think it's true that, Nathan, when we're talking about using counsel, it is. There are times when it's worth the money. And there are times, you know, you have to question the business side of this of the scenario. But in this case, it seems like a no-brainer. If you're going to spend a year or 2 years or 3 years trying to get people from one country to another country, you really can't afford a mistake. You can't.
Right.
I mean, that's just, you just can't afford a mistake. And to have that type of support and guidance makes sense. You know, one of the things I wanted to talk about a scenario here was one with our great, you know, family, if you would say, to the north, Canada. And one of the things we talked about is, or this scenario that we came up with is, you have a company that employs biologists who monitor food processing facilities in Maine. It's yielded a potential hire who listed an address in Yarmouth, Nova Scotia, Canada, on a resume. And after the interview, you and your compliance staff are very impressed with this biologist's credentials and would like to make an offer of employment. So what do you do?
Well, that scenario kind of engenders another it's not really an immigration question, but it has to do with hiring practices in terms of what can you ask of a potential hire as to their immigration status, because the immigration laws, while they control how people move about the United States and how they move into the United States, They also, through related legislation, prohibit discriminatory practices that have the effect of foreign workers. And so there's some guidance out there from the Department of Justice as to what you can ask potential hires. And it's kind of a safe harbor, so you can ask these questions, and if you do, then you're not going to be deemed to be discriminating against foreign workers. So in this case, you probably want to ask because you want to know what kind of business expense you're going to get yourself into by making an offer of employment. And usually the question that you ask is, will you now or in the future require sponsorship for work in the United States? Something along those lines. You don't ask what their person's nationality is. You don't ask questions as to where they live or things like that. You just ask a very general question, yes, no, and then you can proceed from there with details. But that's good business advice for anyone who's confronted with the situation.
Well, the other part that you brought up was, you know, employers have to verify on an I-9, you know, legal immigration status. I'm assuming that employers, even though they've gone through this scenario of getting somebody here on a visa, do they still have to do an I-9? Because they're kind of bringing them in specifically for this. I'm just trying to put that in perspective in terms of HR side of the house.
Well, yeah, Form 9 is required for any new hire after the implementing legislation, which was in 1986. And you're not verifying the immigration status of someone. You're verifying their employment authorization. So U.S. citizens are always authorized for employment, as are permanent residents. But it is required. So once that person actually gets here on any sort of immigration visa, then within 3 days of hire, the employer should be filling out an I-9. And if they're participating in the E-Verify, then doing their E-Verification processes, using, in many cases, the documents that the employer actually helped, you know, obtain. But it's still required from the employment side of things.
Well, we're talking with Nathan Warwicki. He is an employment attorney with Sheehan Finney. We're talking about employment immigration. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on Newstalk WLOB 100.5 FM. We're going to be right back, and we're going to talk about recent developments in employment immigration.
At 154 years old, Verrill Dana has an illustrious history and more than seven generations of legal expertise. With more than 130 attorneys across seven offices from Maine to Washington, D.C., Verrill Dana serves clients across the country and around the world. HR professionals, business leaders, and in-house counsel count on Verrill Dana, one of the premier labor and employment law practices in the Northeast. Contact them today at verrilldana.com.
If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
At highway speeds, the average text takes your eyes off the road for about 5 seconds. That's enough time to travel the length of a football field. Stop texts, stoprex.org. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour on Newstalk WLOB and presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. www.theimmigrantviewpoint.com. And today I'm your host, David Chulo, and co-host David Stearns.
Morning.
And our guest is Nathan Warwicki, and we're going to the last segment today. And you know what I want to do? I want to talk about recent developments. You have told me that in the last month or so, here in September, and that would be back in August, right? In August, there were some changes that happened, some or things that are potentially going to be happening. So why don't you give us some updates, Nathan, on what's going on?
Yeah, you know, most of these updates are changes in the way that the Immigration Service interprets the existing statutes as they relate to immigration. And that's because there hasn't been a real major overhaul of the immigration laws since 1991. So mostly you're dealing with agencies and how they interpret what the statute says. One of the biggest developments in the past year, I would say, is the issue of H-1B mobility. So when you have your foreign workers using an H-1B visa and they're working not at your, not a particular employer work site, but at third-party work sites, what level of control do you need to maintain over these employees to make sure that you're not running afoul of the H-1B regulations? In the H-1B context, there was a case that came out. It's called Simeo Solutions. And in that case, the Immigration Service said that you need to maintain oversight over your employees, even if they're seconded or if they're working at a customer's work site for even a few months. You need to make sure that all that oversight is documented. You need to make sure that you file supplementary documents with the Department of Labor. And that kind of reinforced a existing interpretation, but it created a lot of hubbub in the H-1B world because it did require these filings that previously was kind of a gray area. So whenever you have an H-1B that's moving about and not stationary at one place, there's some extra compliance that needs to happen.
Sure.
And that's relatively new and certainly something that any employer with existing employees should review.
Now, you said there was a potential new ruling coming out. What does that apply to?
Yeah, actually, there should be a proposed rule published by the Immigration Service concerning parole for alien entrepreneurs. So I use the word parole, but that's the word that's in the statute.
Parole?
Parole, right.
Parole, all right. All right. We'll go with that, but go ahead.
So the Immigration Service has the authority to parole into the United States on a temporary basis aliens that it considers to be in the public interest to admit. And that's a pretty amorphous term. That was, by the way, the statutory grounding for the expanded DACA program, which was subject to litigation in the Supreme Court this past summer, the U.S. versus Texas case. But in this context, it has to do with the parole of folks who are going to be working and starting up U.S. companies, obtaining capital from U.S. sources to do that and employ U.S. workers. And it kind of fulfills a need that the current immigration laws really don't have a good answer for. There is no startup visa. Most visas require a sponsor who's established and can document its ability to actually employ somebody, so pay wages and those sorts of things. In this case, there would be an opportunity for someone to come in for a two-year period and maybe an additional three-year period to get that business started up and get its operations in order and then probably transition to a different type of visa. But that's new, and it's kind of exciting for your startup community because it really does fulfill that unfulfilled need. Yeah, I will say that there have been some interesting developments in the vacuum for the startup world, and one of those is in Massachusetts, where there's a push to have public universities and their incubators partner to provide visa status for your entrepreneurs so that mm-hmm. they can work for the university in a part-time capacity but also have time to start up their business. That's one way that the players in the startup community have tried to fill the vacuum, but this parole program, well, it's brand new and hasn't been tested. It also mm-hmm. offers an opportunity.
So how long have you been working in the employment law field?
I've been in the business immigration field for about 8 years.
So you're an expert.
Well, they say it takes 5 years to be an expert, so I'll defer to you on that.
No, and of course we're talking with Nathan Warwicki. He's an employment attorney and a immigration employment expert, and we're talking today about, you know, how to get employees into the country or out of the country, specifically in regards to making this work. Is there anything else you want to leave us with? Anything else? We have a minute left to be able to share with the audience on something that, you know, is important to them.
I would just have your listeners think about where we're at with the immigration process, and they've listened for two episodes now as to the complexity of the processes, and consider where we came from in terms of very limited oversight to where we are now, where there is much oversight and a lot that goes into any particular employment relationship. It takes a lot of planning, and it takes a lot of effort by the employer and the employee to make this sort of thing happen. And so if you do identify that person who really is going to move your company forward and provide a unmet need, I would have that person really think about what makes sense for them and reach out to their resources to try to make things happen the most efficient way possible.
Absolutely. And that, of course, starts with them calling you, Nathan, at She and Finney. And we're certainly going to have this show, as well as your contact information, available at hrpowerhour.com right after this show. Somebody can click on it, can get a hold of you, can listen to this information, can listen to the two shows, the alphabet soup, as we like to say, that they went through. But you've certainly provided us a great overview of not only how to get an employee here, how to deal with it effectively, scenarios that, David, thank you for providing for us today, and also to make sure that we're really ready to make this happen in a legal, effective way. So from both of us here at HR Power Hour, we appreciate you being on the show today.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM. And now your HR Tip of the Week. Your HR Tip of the Week is being sponsored by VeralDana.com.
This is Elizabeth Canellan Smith with Veral Dana. On August 2, 2016, OSHA issued its revised Field Operations Manual for its enforcement employees. Most of the changes in the revised Field Operations Manual have to do with the new maximum fines, which came into effect on that same day. The new maximums include $12,471 per violation for serious, other than serious, and posting requirement violations, $12,471 per violation per day for failure to abate violations, generally limited to 30 days maximum, and $12,709 per violation for willful or repeat violations. Review of safety policies on at least an annual basis will help your workplace avoid any OSHA fines, but as it is virtually impossible to eliminate all risk of injury in the workplace, training and evidence of efforts to prevent injuries will go a long way toward avoiding any OSHA fines. For more information, contact Veral Dana's Labor and Employment Practice Group.
And that's your HR Tip of the Week, sponsored by VeralDana.com.
Next week on the HR Power Hour, we're going to be talking with Ken Lizotte, founder of CareerScape and author of two brand new exciting books, The Speaker's Edge and Discover Your Dream Career.
That's on the next HR Power Hour. Thank you for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 1310 a.m. or streaming live on WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at HRPowerHour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.